81.
And we'll hold over, 4026 till tomorrow, and we repost the other two. And we're going to do the lodging room tax thing first, because Nancy's here.
He listened, he went right away.
And then you have also the ground fees and...
No.
Know that story?
Nothing, apparently. Who's the guy on grounds?
It gets all fired up, no place to go.
Got it.
Your wife says, not tonight, I'm hurt, I got a headache.
Where are... Okay, we're on the record? We are? All right. The House Committee on Revenue for February 11, 2016 will come to order. Colleagues, we have some changes to be made. I want to let you know that we're going to... Is there anybody here today who wants to be heard on House Bill 2046? I didn't see any sign up earlier, and I haven't looked.
4026.
4026, sorry, 4026, the last item on the agenda. I don't see anybody on... We have one? Okay, so we may hear that one today because we posted. My intention is not to work it today. We have Representative Nathanson. Is she here? She is. So we'll open House Bill 4146 for work session and ask Representative Nathanson to come and discuss her Dash 6 amendment. Colleagues, we don't have the paperwork on this, so we can't work it today. But my intention at this point is to repost for Monday, so we make certain we have the paperwork. But we want to hear from Representative Nathanson, because she's available now, and it'll give you a chance to think about the amendment she's proposed. It is my understanding that it's posted in our materials. Oh, okay. Representative Wisnet also wants to be heard. All right, if you two would come up. But look, we're going to hear from Representative Nathanson on the Dash 6.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am here to talk about my amendment, which is the Dash 6. I appreciated the opportunity to hear from organizations with different ideas about how the bill should proceed during the public hearing, and I've incorporated some of those ideas into an amendment that's intended to address several different concerns. So this amendment includes some specific points addressed by three standalone amendments that you have already received previously. So what does this amendment do? It's got some big sections in it. One of the most important ones that will be of most interest to our local areas around the state is it provides more dedicated funds for regional projects. This amendment creates a new fund. 15% will be spent. It's in the form of a matching grant program for tourism-related facilities and tourism-generating events, including sporting events. Currently, Travel Oregon spends about 13% of its budget on a budget area described as destination development. That includes funding for matching grants and also other tourism programming. So the amount here designated in the regional projects, this new fund, will be substantially more than what is going out to projects in the current arrangement. The second thing it does is it establishes a work group, and this is where some of the hard as well as just some of the technical and interesting ideas are going. In my conversations with colleagues and during the hearing, some tensions came out in the open over allocation of funds, over how funds have been shared, how they're used in different regions, and there were some other points about how money is distributed. This amendment establishes a work group and calls out several specific areas that will be covered. For example, the regional share, the amount and policies for distributing funds to regional tourism programs, including a proportional share of the DMO distribution to the county of origin and the boundaries for tourism regions. So there are several different aspects of this related to how regions share money that is allocated to the region, and the work group should discuss all of those. They may even come up with another area that looks promising for discussing how funds are shared. The second thing it does is it wants the work group to discuss establishing an exemption for homeless persons using transient lodging for less than 30 days. The frequency of distributing the state lodging tax and considering quarterly distribution, this is something that was mentioned very specifically, for example, in League of Oregon Cities materials. And data sharing. I heard from a county representative from a county that has been concerned about tax compliance. Suspicions that there are some entities who are paying the state lodging tax but not the local lodging tax. This is obviously a loss of revenue to the local government. It's also just plain not fair to the other businesses. The purposes of sharing data will be to review which entities are paying the tax so the local government can review for tax compliance. It mentions the membership, and there would be a report to a legislative committee by September of this year. The third thing it does, right now, the current statute prohibits the Department of Revenue from sharing any data with local governments. It's just an outright prohibition of sharing data. It fixes that so that Department of Revenue will be enabled then to share it with local governments. It addresses the topic of oversight. There's been interest in increasing transparency and accountability in all aspects of government and public funding. So we're doing that in this amendment also. It directs the Tourism Commission to report to the Legislative Fiscal Office annually and enables LFO to request additional information as appropriate. The last thing it does, you have a specific amendment that's rather technical. It's about a date, needing to bring that date into conformance with standard practice, and so I just incorporated that amendment also into this number six. So you have already heard from representatives of the lodging industry who support the bill, from the Oregon Restaurant Lodging Association, Oregon's seven universities, from the city of Salem. You've received a letter from the mayors of Eugene, Albany, and Corvallis, the CEO of the Central Oregon Visitors Association, a large and a small hotelier, plenty of testimony on this. In short, I believe that this amendment incorporates several ideas. It adds transparency and accountability. It initiates discussions about regional allocations, and it spreads more money to regions around the state. I hope that you will consider this amendment and pass the bill with that amendment.
Thank you very much. Questions for Representative Nathanson? Thank you. Representative Parrish?
Thank you, Representative. Okay. It's in committee right now, in a different committee, and need to pop back there. Members of the committee, for the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37. I'm not here to speak about the underlying or the overarching bill. I am here to talk about the Dash 1 amendment, which simply states that we will not charge a lodging tax to people who are homeless. I don't have the exact homeless data for the entire state right now, but I can tell you for the population I work most in, our veterans population, we have at any given time 4,500 actual homeless veterans. These are people living on the streets, and that's between ODVA and county census work is the number that we see. And sometimes they are able to come in off the street into a hotel or a motel, usually not a Hilton, but when we know where a lot of these types of hotels are in our own communities, or motels, lodging are in our own community. And specifically, we're saying, our most neediest people, you're asking for a tax increase for lodging, but we're going to put that on the backs in some small way of people who really don't have a lot of cash in their pocket to pay that increase or pay it at all. We shouldn't be charging this at all. The question came up about how do you audit this, to Chair, to your question that you asked me before we started. And right before the testimony started, I called Clackamas County. Thank you, Chris Lyons, for getting them on the phone for me quickly. Several of you represent and touch Clackamas County with me. So I reached out to my county. We deliver a lot of homeless services with county and taxpayer dollars. And I asked, how do we determine when someone comes to the county asking for benefits for homelessness? And the answer I got was on the honor system. When people are actually coming and saying that they are in need, we take them at their face value. We do that in DHS, colleagues, when people come and say, I don't have food this week, and we immediately can issue an Oregon Trail card at that day. So when someone's coming to a motel or hotel and they're saying, I'm here and I don't have a place to stay. Or a lot of times, having worked in hotels myself, my minor is in hospitality management, having worked in hotels and checked people into hotels, a lot of times it'll be someone coming to pay with cash, and they're there negotiating for a better rate because maybe the room rate's $49 or $69, but maybe they only have $34, and they still are just trying to come in out of the cold, get a shower. So I can't speak to the larger homeless population. I do know, serving on your housing committee in this building, that the folks in our housing agency warrant to us that we have as many as a need for 50,000 units, affordable housing units. And a lot of those are people who are transient. They're what we would call couch surfing. They're in and out of hotels. And so when we talk about housing and the housing crisis, I just really find it interesting that we would not consider an immediate way for our business industry partners to say, when somebody comes to them and says and warrants that they're homeless, and our own counties are using tax dollars without an audit, they're just saying, okay, if you're coming to our door that you are and you're saying you're homeless, we're going to try to start helping you, that we can't give a tool to our business industry partners in the hotel lodging world, a way to also take somebody on their word at the honor system, that we would not collect even a few dollars. Even if it's a few dollars, that's a lunch, it's a meal, it's maybe helps contribute to their next night in that same hotel. And most people, even though the lodging tax doesn't apply for a long-term stay, most people who are homeless are not coming in and have the money to pay for 30 days. We heard from somebody in the housing committee just this week on some of the bills being deemed as tenant protection. One gentleman came and testified from Representative Davis's district that he has been in and out of hotels since November because he's struggling to find a place to live. That guy shouldn't have to pay a lodging tax, colleagues, and I would urge that we just accept the dash one, no matter where you're at on the under or on the bigger bill. And I personally haven't made a decision on the bigger bill, but let's not charge our homeless people a state lodging tax, please.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr.
I'm going back to committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Barnhart.
Taking your time away from committee.
And honorable committee members, for the record, I'm Gene Wisnett, State Representative, House District 53. It's an honor to be sitting here next to Representative Nathanson. She and I have worked some very tough issues together, and I respect her and respect the work she does in this building. However, today I come to speak in opposition to House Bill 4146. I have not reviewed the amendments, but I'm speaking to the major purpose here in the major bill. As most of you know, I represent Summer Resort, other resorts like Pronghorn, the end of Seventh Mountain, the Bend River House, and many motel, hotel, and overnight rentals in my district, which collect the state lodging tax. Let me be clear, Mr. Chair and Honorable Committee members and Representative Nathanson. I support the Travel Oregon Commission mission. I support funding Travel Oregon. I support Eugene and the University of Oregon hosting the IAAF World Championships. I fully understand the value of this event as an economic benefit for the state. However, I oppose linking these two issues and raising the state lodging tax from 1% for 2% to from 1% to 2%, 100% increase, without more study and agreed plan on how the increased Travel Oregon funding, which is going from $17 million to $34 million, will be used. The regional cooperatives in Central Oregon receive 15% of the 1% lodging tax that they use. Let's put this in reality. This is 15 of every dollar they collect and pay to the state of Oregon, they get 15 cents. This bill is asking for a 100% increase in the state lodging tax now, so we can provide the IAAF World Championship Project $25 million or $5 million per year for 5 years. This creates a significant increased budget for Travel Oregon into the future. Thus, Travel Oregon would have a 100% increased budget forever without an agreed-to plan for this increased funding. There have been discussions about sunsets, and I understand that the good representative has said she would not consider a sunset or a reduced amount from the 1%. And I understand the industry does really not like the sunset because they don't want to improve increased services and operations for 4 years or 5 years and then lose this funding. I have heard from citizens that the bill is not ready for prime time, until it's clear what the distribution of funds will be and what are the rules for the use of these funds. In conclusion, I support funding the IAAF and addressing the needs and plans for increased Travel Oregon funding as separate actions and with more thought and time. In the future, we may be looking at other events at other locations which need money. So we're going to up it another percent and give them more money to run this operation. I think we're setting a bad precedent with this bill. I urge the committee to reject the bill. Then I ask the advocates to suggest an alternative method to fund the IAAF World Championship event and address the need to raise the state lodging tax. How the funds will be allocated and provide more flexibility in the use of the funds. Mr. Chair, I've received two pieces of paper from citizens in Central Oregon. One from the city of Sisters, who opposes this. They're attempting to pass a 9.99% transit room tax increase to the existing 8% they now have, and they're worried about how that will work with this one. The intention behind their increase was to pass 70% of the new additional taxes to the Chamber of Commerce, and the remainder 30% will go to a fund for an affordable housing trust. What tax they put on the cities and the counties, they get all of that. It doesn't go to Travel Oregon, and so they can address what they think are the needs. So they're concerned about that. I had another one that, again, as I do, I support funding the championship. You know, however, all parties that are going to benefit from this are not participating and contributing the money. It's only lodging. As proposed, the proposal as written would, over a 10-year period, would place a burden of over $170 million on the hospitality industry. The $20 million that's assigned to the track event represents approximately 12% over the 10-year period, or 29% over the 4-year assigned period. It's a major overreach at best to accomplish a relatively simple goal, assuming the course that the event actually takes place. There's no guarantee, but there's good representative can speak to that it will get there. Also, Mr. Chair, I'd like to declare a potential conflict of interest.
That sounds like a good idea.
It's going to be interesting, however. So my wife, Josie, has been employed by contract and may in the future with Central Oregon Visitors Association and Sun River Resort, which may benefit from this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. And, of course, you will file your potential conflict with the clerk.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for these two? Representative Nathanson?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to address just a couple of points that have been raised since I believe some of the comments may have been written prior to becoming familiar with the Dash 6 amendment or with the details of the underlying bill. I don't want to take a long time, but there are two specific points I want to address. One that I heard was that some of the persons who are writing in say they would like money to be able to attract events to their area. That is precisely what this bill is intended to do. It's what the underlying bill enabled, and it is especially what in the Dash 6 the additional 15% fund is intended to support. It is to get money, rather than the remainder of the money being available to Travel Oregon to figure out its budget, which is prepared and adopted by the Tourism Commission. Instead of whatever the remainder after the 15% automatic allocation, it says another 15% will be available to the local regions for events and facilities. So that speaks exactly to the point that regions want to be able to spend this money on their own needs for their own purposes. So that's the first thing. Also, with regard to more flexibility in the use of the funds, the underlying bill already addressed that in one way. Right now, in local areas, they understand that the current statute limits their use of the funds to tourism marketing. One of the main points of the bill as written, even without the amendment, is that it removes the word marketing. So this is providing already immediately additional flexibility to the areas to spend money on tourism programs, which could be a facility or some other idea. So the additional flexibility is being provided through this bill. And to the point that regions wanting to be able to have enough money to be able to sponsor and improve their own areas, this bill would immediately bring more money to each region for their own use. I have information available to me that, for example, the Central Oregon region for 2016-17 is scheduled to receive, it's $175,000 on my chart. With this bill, the 2017-18 estimate is $518,000, over a half a million. So that's not even taking into account the Dash 6 amendment, which says additional money will be available for local events and facilities. And then the chart also asks, if any of you want to ask about your region, I could tell you how much your region is scheduled to get this year, 2016-17, and how much under this bill it would receive in the future.
Representative, is that a chart in our materials? I think it is, isn't it?
It might have been provided by Travel Oregon.
And if it isn't, will you make sure that we get it?
I will.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony today. Oh, Representative Leininger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to thank Representative Nathanson for doing a tremendous amount of work in a really focused period of time to try to address concerns that we've heard in testimony and that I've heard expressed to me and that others have provided to her also. This has been a lot of focused work that I think meets needs people identified, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 4146. Thank you. We'll open the work session on House Bill 4084. I think we have Randy Tucker. I'm sorry, who?
Representative McEwen.
Representative McEwen?
Mm-hmm. Brownfield. She's here.
I don't see her. Oh, there she is. Come forward, please.
That's her.
Yes, you wanted to be heard on.
John is waiting.
The OSU button fooled you, I think.
Yes, it did.
We found her.
And I think, Mr. Tucker, you had someone else you wanted to bring?
David Rubino. Could
yes.
You
welcome to join
yes,
us, great. Too, because I'll be very brief.
Thank you. Mr. Rubino? Representative. Thank you for attending today, and I'm sorry I was looking over here and you're over there.
No problem. Thank you, Chair Barnhart and Vice Chairs Bentz and Smith-Warner. Members of the committee, my name is Kathy McEwen. I represent House District 9 down on the South Coast, Coos Bay to Yahats into Mapleton and Scottsburg, not Wells Creek. I am just back today to talk a little bit more about House Bill 4084, the Dash 2 Amendment. I appreciate all of the discussion that occurred during the last hearing. I want to thank Representative Davis and thank Randy Tucker for the good work that they have done, getting very, very far into the details of those questions, bringing the amendment, which I hope answers the concerns and questions that most of you had during the last hearing. I hesitate to go through these line by line. What I think I might do, the Dash 2 amendment, I believe, is up on OLIS now. And I'd like to refer you to that. Mr. Tucker can get into the details, and I know Representative Davis has had some input on one of the changes that occurred at the very end, and I'm happy to have them speak to those. I understand we don't have paperwork to move this bill today. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Okay. So I'm just, once again, happy to be here to ask for your support for this bill. I'm going to turn it over to the gentlemen that have done the lion's share of the hard work in drafting this Dash 2 amendment, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you. I think the committee's fairly familiar with the bill, so if you would go ahead and hit the
high points.
Hit the changes that the Dash 2 does for us. I think that would be appropriate, and then if there are questions, we'll the committee will guide us further on other information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. I've been sort of the, let's see, the traffic cop, maitre d' of this process, I suppose.
The referee at times.
Referee, yes. But I want to state at the outset, many, many people have been involved in the development of this legislation, and really people are trying to just get it right. So I appreciate all the work of all my colleagues in the lobby and also in the legislature that have been actively involved in trying to make sure that this is as clean as possible. I submitted to Mazin a sort of a summary. I'm just going to briefly run through what is in this amendment. So on page one, all the way through from the very beginning of page two, page two, line seven. These are amendments that came from DEQ, and primarily they are intended to provide consistency with the current practice under Oregon law and especially current terminology. As I explained in the first hearing on this bill, there was a term in the bill, environmental site assessments, that doesn't exist anywhere in Oregon law, and so that's been replaced with words that do actually have references in Oregon law. This is a purely technical amendment, and virtually all of these amendments here are purely technical cleanup. On page 2, line 8, you'll see there's a deletion of a statutory reference. That's because that line speaks about excluding Superfund sites from eligibility for this process. However, that statutory reference is to only Portland Harbor, and we didn't intend to just exclude Portland Harbor. We intended to exclude all Superfund sites, so we're deleting that statutory reference. DEQ caught that one for us. Thank you. On page 2, the next three lines 9 to 11, just clean up some language that didn't do what it was supposed to do, which was to indicate that your tax benefits end as soon as you either hit the end of the time period or you've received all of your cleanup costs in tax incentives. On the next line is a substantive change that I discussed with you in the last hearing, which is to increase the threshold for agreement of the taxing jurisdictions from 51% to 75%. So then the next few lines were the occasion of probably 60 or 80 emails over the last week and a half. you're glad you didn't read them all. The question has been, who is not eligible to participate in this program? And the intent of the people that have been working on this, and certainly of the legislators, I believe, I'll let them to speak to that, but I believe this is accurate, is essentially to exclude the people from participating in the program who caused the contamination in the first place. There was an attempt to try to link this to other statutory language, but that other statutory language actually had a different purpose. So it got very, very complicated. And I think this language here that requires an applicant to provide an affidavit saying that under penalty of perjury that they have not by any acts or omissions where there is a duty to act, caused, contributed to, or exacerbated the release of a hazardous substance at the brownfield. That, I think, captures the universe of people that we want to exclude, or that I hope you'll want to exclude. So we can discuss that if you'd like, and David Rubino specifically can speak to that at a much more sophisticated level than I can. The next few lines, starting on page 2, line 19, provide what the county assessors requested, which is the ability to charge a fee, since they're going to be doing a lot of work to keep this program running properly. Starting on line 25 on page 2, this is a question that came up in the coalition, and then Representative Johnson asked me this question offline outside of the hearing. The question was, if the property is transferred, does the property tax benefit stay with the property, or does the new owner have to kind of start from scratch? I am not a lawyer. I do not play one on TV, and I'm not a Latin expert. But I will tell you that in my conversation with Ledge Council, I was notified that property taxes are in rem rather than in personam, and now I know what that means, which means that the property taxes reside with the thing and not with the person. And so this carries forward that legal underpinnings of the property tax system and provides that if there is a transfer, the new owner is eligible as long as they continue to comply with the requirements of the program. I believe that's pretty much what it says.
But this is a clarification that continues to be the case.
And it also makes clear that they have to continue to comply with, you know, the rest of the program. Yes. So let's see. I've lost my place. No. Page 3, lines 4 to 8, that's just another terminology fix, similar to the first page of the bill, of the amendment, rather. Page 3, the next one, lines 9 to 23, clarifies the language that was in the underlying bill didn't do this correctly. Essentially, your tax benefit is determined by upfront your estimate of what the cleanup costs are going to be. And if that estimate changes during the course of your cleanup by more than 10%, then this provides a process for adjusting the tax treatment of the property.
And what's the process?
It just basically provides for the assessors to recalculate the taxes that would be due.
And they would follow their normal valuation process to do that?
Right. In other words, Okay. You at the beginning, you establish, here's what my cleanup cost is going to be. You reduce the taxable value by that much, and then you exempt the improvements as well. If your cleanup
I was asking about process.
Right. It's just So you would then they would adjust that number if there's a significant change in the overall cleanup cost, and then going forward from that point, the tax incentive would be reduced or increased depending on that information.
Thank you. Representative Whitsett, please.
Yes. It's come to my attention through some of these what I would call brownfields in my district that have been purchased and cleaned up, that there are really heavy costs associated with the continued testing by DEQ, often 10 or more years into the future on these. They complete the cleanup, but then DEQ comes back in and they have to each year check, and they check different places on it. So would that then be eligible for a continued tax incentive, that cost that is being incurred by the new owner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsett, I believe that is included in the listing of eligible costs that is not changed in the amendment, but in the underlying bill, Section 3, page 4. But I'm trying to read while I talk. It includes the cost of environmental audits, monitoring other than water monitoring, et cetera. Those are included. However, of course, it's still subject to the time limit of the underlying tax benefit, and also to the cap on overall costs that can't exceed your cleanup costs. So, yes, partially, I think, is the answer. Okay. In other words, if you're monitoring 20, 30 years into the future, I don't believe this program solves that problem for you.
Okay, that answers my question, sort of, because they are differential regarding the property and the length of time that they are required to be monitored by DEQ, and what they find as they monitor in different places. Typically, it's taking soil and water samples, and we have some places in Klamath that are 10 years out now that have been cleaned up, and it's significant, the cost to monitor after the cleanup is done. So
on that question, David, who actually practices in this area, may be able to talk to you about how things actually work, but I will say once again that this bill, you know, is not a panacea for all costs associated with brownfield cleanup. It may help in that initial 10 to, you know, up to 15-year period. And beyond that, I think there will have to be other tools that would come into play.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I'm almost finished here. On page 3, line 29, up into the early part of page 4, there is Wendy Johns from the League of Cities testified last time about the opportunity to cure minor defects in you know, paperwork problems or whatever for an applicant. And so this language is intended to address that, to avoid disqualification for minor missteps that are not inconsistent with the intent of the program. And then you've got a bunch of section renumbering, and the final change is that we have reduced the sunset in the bill. The original bill had a 20-year sunset. And I will say there was kind of a misunderstanding, I believe, between myself and the drafter, and in taking a look at it and having some people approach me between the first hearing and now, it seemed like, well, let's do something that's more in line with other statutes. And so we've reduced it from 20 years to 10 years.
Okay. Now, this is a sunset on the date on which a program like this can begin, or is it the date on which it must finish?
The way we've attempted to draft this is as a soft sunset,
yes,
where if you're in the program, you can continue. But I think for any new properties to be authorized under the program, there'd have to be an extension of the sunset or a lifting of the sunset by the legislature.
Or they have to bring it in within the 10 years.
Yes. I'm sorry?
They have to begin within the 10 years.
That's right. That's right. Anything that starts before the sunset gets continue, but you can't start anything new after the sunset unless the legislature extends the program.
Did you have a statement you wanted to make, or are you here to answer questions?
State your name for the record. I'm here to answer a question. I have no separate statement.
And state your name for the record so we've got you.
My name is David Rubino. I'm an attorney with Tonkin Torp in Portland, Oregon.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Davis?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think now that we've had the pleasure of being in the weeds of of this amendment, it might be helpful for us to step back for 3 or 4 minutes and hear how this might actually work in an actual example of a property. That question came up, I think, from a number of committee members at the first committee, and I think those who are testifying are prepared to give us an example.
Ah, okay. Great. Please.
So I prepared, Mr. Chair, as a hypothetical example of a smallish property. Oh, and it's up there.
Yes.
Great. I just made this up just so you can see how the numbers would work. In this case, the example that I provided is of a property that, if it were clean, would be worth $200,000, but you've got $100,000 of cleanup costs, and that after a couple of years, it's cleaned up, and then after another year, there's something built on it that's worth $500,000. And without slogging through all the details, in this case, over 10 years, and that's assuming that you've cleaned up pretty quickly and you've built something pretty quickly, the savings would be $64,500. If the local government had some criterion for extending the program another 5 years, then you could actually max out and collect all of your cleanup costs in that case. However, that's assuming a 1.5% tax rate. If the tax rate were lower, then you'd be less likely to recover all your cleanup costs. If you completed the cleanup later, completed your improvements later, you'd be less likely to recover all of your cleanup costs in terms of taxes not paid that you would otherwise owe. And so I just provided this as an example to get a sense, first of all, of how it worked, and also, second, that not every property is going to claim all of its cleanup costs. Of course, as you know, there's a bullet down at the bottom that says, I didn't take into consideration measures 5 and 50, so I'm living in the world of theory here a little bit. I think there is obviously a wide variety of types of properties that this could apply to. But to go to the question that Representative Helm asked me in the first hearing, what kind of properties do we think this is going to apply to? Anyone who applies and is accepted, of course, that's not excluded by the terms of the statute. But I think the mindset behind this is it will be mostly smaller properties, that have historically been gas stations and repair shops and metal fabrication facilities and the like. And as you know from the first hearing, large industrial properties are most likely excluded from participation anyway because they are probably state-appraised industrial properties. So I just chose a sort of a gas station-sized example to see how the numbers ran.
And this is an improvement from the standpoint of a buyer, to the extent of the present value of the $64,500 in your example, if
correct.
I understand it correctly. And one assumes that a knowledgeable and arm's length buyer and seller would calculate what the value of the property actually is, based on their assessment of what the cost of cleanup is going to be, the value of the property as a clean property. The value of the tax break and any other tax breaks or other breaks there might be out there, and then one assumes they arrive at a price that's somewhere between $100,000 and $200,000 if the $200,000 is the value of the property clean. Is that your assessment too, or have I missed something?
I think that's right, Representative. The intent of this is to create an incentive for something to happen where things are not happening now.
Right.
So in many cases, you've got properties that are owned by someone that doesn't have the resources to do the work, and nobody wants to buy it off of them. But this kind of an incentive could create it, could create the opportunity to actually turn that property into something productive and something that can, that's no longer degrades the value of neighboring properties and also provides, you know, some productive development on it. You're right. I mean, I think this program, if it were in place in a local jurisdiction, would most likely be factored into people's considerations of what they might pay for a piece of contaminated property.
Or whether they'd offer anything at all.
Right.
Yeah. Please.
No, I think Randy hit it on the head. There's not really much more to add on that. I think the one issue is going to be, how do you ultimately know what the cleanup costs are? So there's always some downside risk, which is in some measure what this incentive can help the buyer overcome, because they know that should they increase, they have the ability to at least get some of that back through including those costs later in the tax abatement process. But like any other tax abatement or tax credit that could apply to a property transaction, one would assume that knowledgeable buyers and sellers will try and put a monetary value on this during the time they do their deal.
And one other factor, I assume that a buyer might very well ask the seller to participate in that risk.
They can. A lot of times sellers are unwilling to remain on the risk at that point. I mean,
right.
If there's a way to get out, they want to be done.
Sure.
So more often than not, they look to get out from underneath the property entirely, leaving all the risk with the buyer.
Thank you. See, that's where your experience is helpful, I think, to us, because I can make up lots of hypotheticals. I have no idea how they connect to the real world.
Yeah. In most of the smaller properties to which this is likely to apply, you're not looking at a scenario where an indemnity agreement is really going to be worth very much, because the seller may not be around to honor it anyway. And more often than not, the seller wants to be out because they would have taken care of the problem had they been able to. So there's always a look for finality in these types of transactions.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Yes, please.
I think you have to look at this. It's actually going to help a segment of properties that are on the margin. And the margin, the owner is not going to fix it because it costs too much. However, if they sell it at a real market value, and then you amortize the cleanup cost, at the end, it's worth it. So it will incent the owner to sell. The buyer gets a good deal, and at the end, they get the tax break. But they won't get the tax break if they fix it themselves, because the tax break is a special assessment of the real market value minus the costs. So if the costs are too bigger than what the real market value today is, there is no incentive to sell.
So the thing actually only applies to a buyer.
And it applies to a segment of properties that are on the margin. If you add this thing to them, they'll start moving in the market. Otherwise, they will not.
And none of us have any idea what percentage of these smaller brownfields would be benefit from this mechanism, do we?
Mr. Chair, we really don't know. I mean, I haven't had the opportunity to really study what's happened in other states, for instance, and I think we're allowing cities to give this a try. Okay. Cities may want to put some sideboards of their own in terms of total funding they want to allocate to it, or, you know, length of time that they would like to try it, pilot projects. They may want to protect themselves in that way. The underlying assumption is that it's a win. You know, last year when we were here, you had a presentation about some of the scoping work that's been done for various brownfield cleanup strategies, and the work that we had done in our region showed that if you cleaned up about 800 acres in the Portland region, at a total cost, which was estimated in this report, of about $47 million, that you'd have annual property tax benefits in the future of about $125 million. It's viewed as a big win if you can get that upfront work done.
Yeah.
We'll have to see, obviously, how it really works out, if it works out.
Right. Thank you. Representative Davis?
Thank you, Chair. And I think Mazin stole the thunder. Stole the question I was actually going to ask Dave, which is great, which is the inducement effect at the margins. But I think having David down here to maybe talk about having worked with buyers and sellers with those properties on the margins, how do you see this affecting the numbers in the transaction, or do you see it affecting those numbers in the transaction?
It should definitely affect the transaction. I mean, if you use the example that Randy put up, which is a perfectly good one to use, so if the tax savings is about $64,500, some of the initial site assessment work can run anywhere between $20,000 to about $60,000. So you can start looking at a buyer who can say, I can actually recoup some of my early upfront costs that are going to help me define what the scope of the problem is, because only after you do that do you really know what the cost of the cleanup is. Shy of that, everyone's just taking their best guess. Hmm. And depending how much sampling has been done, that can be plus or minus 30 to 50%. So the number that you think the cleanup can be very early on could dramatically increase as you get more and more sampling done later. So in these smaller projects where you are talking about a difference of, you know, a delta of $50,000 to $60,000, that can make or break whether this pencils out at all. So the idea of being able to recover some of those costs down the road, I think, would make a lot of these types of projects significantly more attractive to potential buyers. I mean, anyone who's going to look to buy a brownfield probably has a slightly better appetite for risk than others, but you still want to help
yeah,
them.
Yeah.
There's a reason to provide some incentive and reward for them to be willing to take that risk on.
Well, and just a follow-up comment, which Randy alluded to, in that this number talks about total tax savings at the end of those 5 years. Of course, it doesn't address the billions in tax receipts that will be coming in after these properties are redeveloped. So looking at a 30- or 40-year time span at a property that might otherwise sit there for those 30 or 40 years, as we heard Representative Frederick testify to, the upside in the long term, I think, could be positive, although it would be probably decades before you'd see that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my numbers say trillions.
Yeah. Oh.
Chair, our ballpark impact station goes only 3 biennia, so
yes. Yeah, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for all the hard work on this. So it takes 51% vote or agreement of the taxing districts to let this go forward.
We've amended it to say 75%.
And of that 75%, right, if we were to look at who it is that usually makes up that group, is it the school district? Who's going to have most of the say about that? In that 75% number, who is most likely to have the most committed to this exercise?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Bentz, I actually, you probably know better than I do how property taxes generally break down in a given jurisdiction in terms of the percentage that is the city, the county, special districts, and school districts. I'm not super smart about that. My understanding is that, you know, in many cases you'll be able to have, if you have the city and the county and the school district, that might get you there. But I actually don't know the normal breakdown. And I think the special districts, when they asked for that number to be changed, they said, you know, what it does is it forces a conversation among the local jurisdictions. And there may be dissenters in that 25%, but you know, we agreed to go to 75, but I'm not really answering your question. I don't know the answer.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I think it's going to vary widely depending upon, because it applies to every assessment, no matter what the source. So in different districts, there's going to be different assessments. So whoever's going to be contributing is going to vary widely. But that's okay. I was just curious if you'd run some numbers to see if it's normal, if you will, the school district's paying most, because that'd be my guess.
No. And, you know, we were kind of looking at some models, and I'm not the guy that has focused primarily on those models. I know there were a number of models that of existing property tax exemption programs, hoping I'm using the right term, that have a 51% threshold, and there are others that use a 75% threshold. And we just, you know, worked with the coalition to come up with the recommendation here.
Of course, we're opening a topic which is quite a bit bigger than this bill. When these kind of ideas were originally set up, I think before 1990, and before the legislature in the early 90s set up the state school fund process the way it is now, school districts actually had skin in the game directly in these kinds of decisions. And now they don't, because any funds they lose as a result of this kind of a tax break is replaced all but a few cents from the state school fund. But that's not a conversation for this bill. That's a much larger conversation for the committee, I think, to determine whether or not that kind of formulaic approach, which includes the school as a major contributor to that 75% number or the 50% number, whether that ought to continue, whether we should just assume that the school votes no and you have to do it with what's left or something else. But that's not, in my opinion, Representative, that isn't a topic for this bill simply because it's a big topic. And except for what I've said just now, I don't know that it's ever been directly raised in the committee, although all of us have thought about it. Is that helpful at all?
Mr. Chair, moderately. My point was, it's good that everybody knows who it is that's actually investing in the cleanup, and the who is going to depend upon who's not being paid, who's foregoing that money that otherwise would have been paid over the future 15 years that this bill contemplates. And so it's always of interest to me to see how these decisions made years ago are kept in the mind of those who 10 years after see that $500,000 or whatever it is that's costing the community a lot for whatever reason. I think the hypothetical
right.
before was filled with kids going to schools.
Right.
And then the issue becomes who made this decision and why? And then we go back and look at the decision that was made all those years ago. Anyway, that was your point, of course, is right. And it did come up earlier in the last conversation. I think went back and looked.
In this conversation,
on this bill.
That's right. Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, actually, after we had our conversation last week, and I kind of misspoke about and was later educated about the way the school funding formula works. I also thought of, with respect to your example, the one piece that we didn't discuss is all of the jobs that were created in building the residences that house those, I forget how many hundred school children on the hypothetical property. So, you know, it's definitely, there are a lot of trade-offs with respect to property taxes being foregone up front, with respect to the impacts on the state school fund and the impacts on, you know, other districts, and with respect to the benefits of the cleanup. And that those are the kinds of trade-offs that we would anticipate that local governments in establishing these programs would be discussing.
Right. One issue we haven't actually hit today is the value of the land cleaned up to the community.
Right.
If we're talking about an eyesore downtown in the middle of a business area, there may be a lot more interest on the part of the city and the other taxing districts, for that matter, to getting a cleanup done. They may even figure out a way to add another incentive of some kind to do that. Whereas if it's something on the outskirts in the corner that nobody pays much attention to, they probably have a different incentive to do it. That doesn't affect this bill, I don't believe.
Right.
But I can picture some properties right downtown in some of my small communities that might get a lot more attention, and maybe even some additional support of some kind in addition to this in order to get it done, whereas other properties would not be of that much interest. Yeah. Thank you. Yes, Representative Pound, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a related question in that, and thank you, Randy, for providing a little more clarity on the likely locations that might be candidates
right.
here. Thinking a couple of steps beyond that, is there any way we could anticipate the type of development that we're going to get out of these locations and this program at this point in time? Is I know the intent of the program is to be completely neutral, but is there any way, you know, we have in Portland, we have a affordable housing crisis, for example. Is there any way to tell whether this program could actually make a dent in that now? or are we, or is there an indication that we're going to get a type of redevelopment that is more business oriented?
Mr. Chair, Representative Helm, I don't think I can predict exactly what will happen, or even vaguely what will happen, but I can say that I would imagine that the underlying zoning of a given property would have a lot to do with what gets built on it, and also that, as I believe we discussed last time, we've included language in the bill that allows, let me just find it, it's, I believe I can find it easily, here we go, page 2, line 32, the city county report may adopt any other provisions relating to the, no, that's not it, I'm sorry. Anyway, okay, here it is. The ordinance or resolution may allow for an additional period not to exceed 5 years based on criteria set forth in the ordinance or resolution. That's page 2, line 22. The idea there is that if it's a priority for a local government to clean up brownfields in order to have affordable housing built on that brownfield, that local government can choose to establish that priority in their ordinance. If it's a priority for them to create jobs, they can establish that criterion in their ordinance and provide an extra incentive with additional years of tax incentive, essentially, in order to achieve those objectives. So there's a way for the local government, if they wish, to steer the program in that direction. Beyond that, I am not able to predict what might happen.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Sorry? Yes, please. Mazin.
I think, Representative Helm, there are a few different types, I think, of properties. The ones that have such a market appeal, and they could be, you know, become profitable quickly, whether you have this program or not, they're already in the market. Somebody cleaned them up. And this comes the second section. This needs a little help. This is a slightly little help. You have price. The cleanup is higher than the price. You allow it to go up. You recover that, and you put it back in the commercial market. I think mostly commercial. The housing will probably not, because it's affordable housing. It's a little right. So it is not to be of that benefit.
We'll need extra incentives beyond this if we expect to get housing out of
right.
It. Very helpful. Thank you.
It's got to go on lower cost land. Yeah. Thank you. With that, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 4084, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 4081. Kyle, I think that's yours. I think you can describe, I better gavel 4081, and then Kyle, go ahead and explain the amendment to us, if you would, and what this is about. It's been a few days since we've heard it.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So, yeah, I'll start with just the underlying bill and then get to the amendment. But just to remind the committee, the House Bill 4081, it's dealing with a property tax exemption or expansion of an existing exemption from a few years back in House Bill 4039 in 2014. So, and 4039 was in response, or more or less in response, to a court case regarding certain properties that are owned by nonprofit organizations that are used for low-income housing. And there was a court case. These properties were receiving a property tax exemption under ORS 307-130. There was a court decision saying that exemption shouldn't really apply to these types of properties. They don't qualify under that statute. So it would essentially make these properties taxable. It did so for the ones in the court case, and then it could touch on the ones throughout the state as well, because it's saying current law is exemption wouldn't apply to these type of properties. So House Bill 4039 was passed, and it more or less grandfathered in properties that were receiving exemption as of property tax year 2012-13. So they were receiving exemption under ORS 307-130, and it said they'll continue to receive the exemption up until June 30th, 2018. So it was the sunset on this grandfathering in. House Bill 4081, what it was doing was it removes that sunset date. Now the dash one to 4081, rather than removing the sunset, it places it 4 years out. So it would now sunset June 30, 2022, rather than June 30, 2018. So it just moves that 4 years out. that's my synopsis, I suppose, of it. And we do have the paperwork I can describe if you want to talk about the revenue impact or the fiscal. We can do that as well.
Yes, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I recall from when we had a hearing and some testimony on this that there were suggestions that there were perhaps other parts of the tax law that these organizations might be able to utilize in order to maintain their tax-exempt status. And I just wondered how this interacts with that.
Yes, Representative Smith Warner. That is, there are other nonprofit low-income housing statutes that would provide exemption. A specific one in mind, it has the opt-in, opt-out, so the 51%, which the committee was hearing about just on 4084. So it may not be a full exemption. It could be a partial exemption. It could be some taxing districts, but not all of them. Whether or not these properties in question could qualify for that, it's likely that they possibly could. It may take some changes on their part on how they're structured or something on those lines, or whether that's even available where these properties are. So it's no guarantee that all these properties would simply move into another exemption, but it is certainly a possibility.
And I guess if I may follow up, I just wondered if we, you know, if there had been any further talk either with the parties or anyone about moving them in that direction as well, or is the understanding that we're going to keep extending the sunset, or?
I had a conversation with some of the proponents of this measure. I think we need to be aware of a couple of things. There's an old adage, yes, which goes something like this, hard cases make bad law. Mm-hmm. And the hard case in this situation is that it is my understanding that some of the assessors changed their views about the application of this general exemption statute after the fact. And having done that, properties that had taken advantage of that exemption could have been in a situation where they were no longer able to finance, no longer able to meet the financial requirements of paying all of their other expenses plus the added-on property tax bill. So they came to the legislature asking for relief. We gave them relief based on the date of the bill going backwards. This is an extension that gives them a couple more years comfort, as it were. But we also had a conversation that this would be a part of the discussion by the work group working on the general property tax exemption rule, and with the hope that those four extremely capable legislators would come up with a plan that would allow us to move forward. Now, when you look at this issue on the other side of it, what Kyle said is absolutely correct. Some of those exemptions now require approval from municipalities for application. This particular one that these were originally under did not. And so you have the situation where you have property that you have people who've already invested in these properties, you have people living there, you have low rents that only can cover the other costs, and municipalities are not willing to make the extension for reasons of their own that we may or may not consider to be valid, but in any event are required under the other statute. So we're in one of those situations where you have a couple of thousand units around the state of affordable housing that ends up being left high and dry if we don't do something like this as a stopgap. I have, frankly, no interest in continuing this kind of a stopgap. I think what we need is a fix. I don't know what the fix is. And that's what our wonderful work group is going to figure out for us. That's my summary, at least, of why we need the bill.
Okay.
And simply simply repealing the sunset isn't the solution. But I agree with you. By implication, I think you're suggesting just rolling sunsets over on into the future isn't an answer either, and I agree with that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Other comments? Yes. Yes, please. What's it?
I was wondering if the lobbyists for the Associated Oregon Cities could come up.
Well,
I just have a question. I just want to make sure that I have these numbers right. It was my understanding, I think it was from her, that regarding general property tax collected, It was $11 billion last year, and $24 billion was exempted in this state.
Correct. Let's ask Kyle to answer that.
Okay,
you need to look at it's in our basic facts, isn't it? There is a section in the basic facts document that talks about that. Most of that $24 billion is property that is exempt as a result of federal law, not state law.
But nevertheless, excuse me.
Could you go ahead? Could you give us a quick précis about that issue? The amount in this bill is tiny compared to those numbers.
Right. I'm just looking at the overall, what we're collecting and what we're exempting in the state.
Yes, Representative Whitsitt. Overall collections, I think for the most recent property tax fiscal year, we're at about $6
billion. $6 billion?
For the year. The revenue loss that you speak of for property tax exemptions, I would have to consult. There's a chart in the governor's tax expenditure report that details some of the revenue loss at a really high level. On the property tax side, I would caution that that includes such things as intangible property for personal use, or intangible property, personal property for personal use, federal property, state-owned property. There's a lot of those in there that really do contain some of the large numbers are those ones that you could make an argument they were excluded from the base in a way that makes it more easy to write the statute, not that they were ever intended to be included.
Mm.
But I can definitely get you more detailed information.
And I think the committee would welcome a bill that would tax intangible property and personal property, and we'd be certainly happy to discuss it.
It would?
And I think the committee correctly recognizes that I don't really mean that. The vast majority of the number is property that we're simply not going to consider taxing, or it's property we can't tax. Anything else? Any other questions? Representative Leininger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to note we've been talking about this over a bunch of different days, and from my perspective, I think that testimony that was really compelling was a lot of these projects have been built and the pro formas were developed based on an understanding of the property tax exemptions that exist right now. And while this work group is going to be considering the issue over the next year and hopefully develop some good consensus recommendations that you'll be interested in the next session, I think extending the sunset in the meantime so they can have some certainty, subject to, you know, what the legislature does in the future, makes good sense. So I'm going to be supporting this bill today.
Thank you. Other comments? Representative Vance?
Mr. Chair, I agree with just about everything that's been said on this. I had a great deal of hesitation in supporting this this particular extension for the reasons you've already mentioned. Not because of the value of that which they're doing not being valuable. It is. It's just that in the work group, we have to address these issues, and I didn't want to be foreclosed and how we might approach them by virtue of this particular bill. So I'm happy to see the sunset. I'll be supporting the bill.
Thank you. And then do you have a motion?
I do have a motion, and I did want to take this opportunity to mention, to build on the remark that was made about all the stuff that we can't tax by virtue of the federal exemption, but it's still costing us money. And for some reason, this refuge situation is coming to my mind.
That hasn't impinged on your attention lately, has it?
No, it hasn't. But I was just saying there's an enormous amount of law enforcement expense there, and where's the money? But anyway, yeah. Moving along.
I heard there's no more problems out there as of this morning.
I'll take care of.
So oh, really?
Yeah,
oh. Right. You'll give us the news later.
And the bill.
And the bill.
Right. Representative Benz,
yes,
please.
Yes, I move the -1 amendment to House Bill 4081.
Representative Benz moves the -1 amendment after that digression off into something else. Any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Representative Benz.
Chair, I move House Bill 4081 to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves the House Bill 4081 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it is so ordered. Who are the sponsors of the bill?
Evans and Davis.
So do the two of you want to fight over who's carrying, or do you want to co-carry?
We can co-carry. We'll be brief.
All right. Evans and Davis will...
I'm always brief.
We're going to read the whole bill, too.
Yeah. We'll co-carry. and with that,
that was
the
so much fun
work
today.
Session on House Bill 4081 is closed. Paul, we've got one bill that we haven't talked about, and that's and we have a public hearing scheduled on that one, don't we? We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 4026. I think we have somebody who wants to be heard on that public hearing today, don't we?
Two.
Mike Dewey and Jeremy Rogers, please come forward. Do you want to give us the short version of the pricing of this bill?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is the bill that would move the state from the cost of performance to a market-based approach for the apportionment of corporate sales related to intangibles and services.
Great.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. My name is Jeremy Rogers, the Vice President of the Oregon Business Council. And I'm really here today just to urge the committee to slow down on this issue. I apologize that I was not here to testify yesterday, but I think that's part of the issue here is that while I was aware of this basic issue of market sourcing versus cost of performance, the details I was not very aware of. And I spend quite a bit of time on tax issues, and I think this is an issue for which the details, you know, are not really that well known by business organizations and even many businesses without serious consideration by their accountants and their tax attorneys. I've spent the last couple days doing my homework to try to learn a little bit more. I was also in a meeting with some of the state's top tax lawyers and accountants 2 days ago and mentioned that the legislature was considering, mm-hmm. you know, taking this issue up in the short session, to which they couldn't believe I was serious. But I said, there's amendment. And so many of them support an eventual shift to market sourcing, but explained that just how complicated this is and how each state has taken a very different approach and that the consequences of those approaches are significant. One gentleman who works for one of the major accounting firms told me that he had just finished a 2-year project helping one of his clients understand the new market sourcing rules in their state. Now, I know that you've been talking about the multi-state tax commission, mm-hmm. but no state has taken the multi-state tax commission and adopted that. Each state adopts a system that makes the most sense for their state based on their you know, makeup of companies. And there's all sorts of different decision points that can be made. There's, you know, sourcing based on where the benefit of the service is received, sourcing based on where the service itself is received, sourcing based on where the service is delivered, sourcing based on where the customer is located. And when you're dealing with intangibles, you're dealing with software that goes to a cloud and that's used by people all over the world, this gets very, very complex. And I don't suggest that I know it very well, but I think that's one of my big concerns with moving this so quickly in the short session. OBC doesn't have an official position on this because we've never had the chance to really take the issue up in depth, but I just wanted to be here to caution you that moving quickly could have significant consequences for Oregon companies and potentially for state revenue. So, thank you.
Questions? Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I spent a great deal of time the last 2 days doing just what you were doing. A couple of cases that came up, the Lanco case in New Jersey and the MBNA case in West Virginia. Did they talk about those cases?
I'm not familiar with those. They didn't talk about those. Yeah. But I could be happy to learn more and ask about them if you'd like.
Mr. Chair, I would just point out that, of course, as each state moves to advance its own interests, these neighboring pesky states seem to disagree with everybody's attempt to grab this limited pile of corporate revenue. And so the Supreme Court, as I understand it, refused to rule on a case that perhaps could have given us some direction. And that refusal has opened the gate to many of most of the people I've spoken with have said brief opportunities for great confusion as it's sorted out at the so-called higher level of the courts. Anyway, that was the lesson I learned.
Thank you. Representative Nelson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just really curious. You listed, or you said you consulted different tax accountants or firms or consultants, and I was curious if you'd tell us who you talked to.
Yeah, sure. I was at a meeting that included So the meeting was not specifically on this issue, but it came up. That included Robert Manicky at Stoll Reeves, Rob O'Neill from Moss Adams, Gary Reynolds from Perkins and Company. Those are three in the room. Nikki Dobay, who I think you heard from the Council on State Taxation, she was in the room for that as well. They've dealt with this in many states.
Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, Representative, what's it?
I was just wondering, in your opinion, if you think this bill is written, makes or chooses winners and losers among businesses in Oregon, that essentially the government would be setting up, that it's divisive among businesses, I guess.
Representative Witt said, I think that it does set up winners and losers, and the problem is we don't know who those are, because I think that's the issue. There's going to be winners and losers to moving to market-based, and there's going to be winners and losers on which approach to market-based you take, and without understanding who those winners and losers are, I think it's unwise to move forward.
Thank you. Other questions? I've just added a little bit to that answer, and I agree with it. When we went to the current system we have for tangible property, there were winners and losers, too. The object, I think, of the legislature at that time was to make the winners be in-state companies and the losers be out-of-state companies who sold in Oregon, and that to encourage them to become winners by moving into the state. I think the object of this bill is similar. Whether it fits, works in exactly all cases, of course, is another question. Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you.
With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4026. Colleagues, I don't intend to open the work session on that bill today. I do expect there will be some reposting of bills, probably for next week, some of these bills that are here in front of us. We did get one of them out today, so consider that a success. And you have gained 27 minutes. And with that, the committee is adjourned.